This is a 720 to go podcast from Chicago's WGN Radio 720.
This podcast is sponsored by ADM.
As one of the world's largest agricultural processors, ADM is uniquely positioned to serve the world's growing needs for abundant food and renewable energy. ADM.
When it comes to the business of America's farmland, you need the information from the people who know it best. That's why we bring you AgriCast with Orion Samuelson and Max Armstrong.
Thank you very much, and good morning, everyone. Good morning, world, as we come your way for our weekly visit here on WGN Radio on Saturday morning. And a week ago today, we were in Arizona at a cattleman's event, and then midweek, we were in Madison, Wisconsin for World Dairy Expo, and we'll share some of the highlights from each of those events coming up here on the Saturday morning show. As a matter of fact,
growers, we invite you to come and learn how to turn practical data and technology into profitable decisions at the second annual Ag Data Conference. It'll be going on at Coralville, Iowa, coming up the end of November. Making sense of precision technology and the data layers derived from it are key to improving your corn and soybean return on investment. And the best way to learn is from actual experience of other farmers and their advisors, along with a hands-on look at the data products, the drones, and the services that drive success. You'll gain insight and more from the Ag Data Conference, designed by the editors of Farm Progress Information brands Corn Soybean Digest and Farm Futures. Get all the information of the Ag Data Conference by going to the website, theagdataconference.com. It's November 29th and 30th at the Coralville Marriott Hotel near Iowa City, Iowa. theagdataconference.com.
10 minutes after five, and we're going to head Arizona way here when we continue on the Saturday morning show. Every time I visit Arizona, I like to check in with Mark Killian, who is the Director of Agriculture for the Arizona State. And we'll begin by asking, what kind of a year has it been for agriculture in Arizona?
You know, we're having a good year. Cotton's up and down. Alfalfa's floating there. Cattle prices seem to be stabilizing. The vegetable people have done really well. We have this huge market in pecans. The Chinese have discovered pecans in Arizona. They love them. We can't grow enough for them. There's just a lot of good things happening in Arizona with agriculture.
So a lot of your product off farms and ranches moves into foreign trade?
We export to 78 different countries around the world. And a lot of the seeds that we grow go into northern Mexico. We export alfalfa to India, Saudi Arabia, Japan, China. We export a lot of products out of this state.
And then let's talk about the weather that you've had so far. Been a little different, hasn't it?
Yes. In some parts of the state this summer, excuse me, it was very hot.
Yep.
But during the monsoon season, we got an awful lot of rain in a lot of areas. A lot of the state that was brown looks like Ireland now. We've had some late rains. We did have some severe fires, but they got control of those. But by and large, we're a lot better off today than we were 2-3 years ago.
So what's the biggest issue that you're currently dealing with?
I think I'm going to split that with three things.
Okay.
One is cuts to the USDA. We're all very concerned about that. I think we're very concerned about regulation and where the administration's going with that, like Waters of the U.S. and things like that. We're watching that very carefully. And then the third thing is control of water within the state. There's a lot of discussion, and it's the typical fight between the urban areas and the rural areas. And I think we'll work that out, but it's piqued everybody's interest, and we're watching it very carefully.
Gulf is a big tourist industry in Arizona, and it takes water. Is there a fight between golf courses and cotton growers?
No, I don't think so. I think when you look at Arizona's economy altogether, ag is a $20 billion industry. It's got 88,000 employees. It continues to grow. Yes, we use 80% of the water, but golf is kind of agriculture. I mean, it's turf and ornamentals, so they're part of the family. Even though they're kind of the strange cousin, they're part of the family, and that contributes. And so many of those people that come here and visit us and play golf, they buy our ag products. They take things home with them. And many of them decide they want to move to Arizona. So we're kissing cousins.
The NAFTA situation, is that a major concern for your producers?
Oh, it's a huge concern. Mexico and Arizona are huge trading partners. For example, this year Mexico will import through the port of Nogales 5.4 billion pounds of fruits and vegetables. Most of the seeds that northern Mexico gets for their vegetables comes from Arizona. We trade beef, cattle, and so manufacturing. And our governor has a wonderful commission, Arizona-Mexico Commission, where we meet several times a year where we talk about how we make it easier to trade between our partner. And we love Mexico and that relationship. And we hope we can, particularly on the ag side, we can preserve that relationship.
And clarify for me, because it's a number I've heard often on the labor situation. Every morning in Yuma, Arizona, 30,000 people come across the border to work here?
That's correct. There are thousands of our Mexican family that come across the border. They start at 3 and 4 in the morning to get across the border. And Yuma is totally dependent on that labor source, because Yuma grows 90% of the winter vegetables for America from November to May 1st. And without those good folks, we would be in a world of hurt. And they work hard and they do such a good job. And there's generations of families who've come across the border, and they're experts at picking those vegetables.
Well, thank you for the visit and the positive report on agriculture in Arizona.
Thank you.
Mark Killian, the Director of Agriculture for Arizona.
In our busy week, one of the people we had the opportunity to visit with is the new Pig Farmer of the Year, Leslie McQuestion from Nebraska, but not originally. We want to get your story, Leslie, but first, congratulations to you in this role that you'll be serving the pork industry as a spokesperson over the next year.
Thank you very much, Max. It's an honor to be here and a privilege to be the Pig Farmer of the Year.
How did you get to this point? Where did you start out life? How did you get involved in the ag industry? Did you grow up on a farm?
I absolutely did. I actually grew up on a cattle farm in southwest Oklahoma. My family actually still raises cattle and small grains out in western Oklahoma and actually southwest Kansas even at this point. So I did grow up in ag. It was actually a really nice fit, but when I went to college, I did livestock judging, and from there I started a degree in psychology. I had grown up wanting to help children, and so I thought, I want to be a child psychologist. Well, a few years in, and I decided I wanted to go back to agriculture, transferred to Oklahoma State, and got an ag econ degree, ag economics degree. And from there, I did an internship with Cargill Pork. And almost the rest is history from that point. I did a lot of things with them over the years, doing research, working in our breed-to-wean farms, working in our wean-to-market farms. I even got time to spend at our processing plants. It's really exciting to be able to see the full scope of what we do as pig farmers every day, from farm to fork, literally. And after that, I did decide to take a little bit of a break and went to Dallas and worked at a vet clinic for about 2 years, working with puppies and kittens. But the pig farmer part of me kind of came back, and I decided to go back to Columbus, Nebraska, working for the Mashoffs in pig farming again. And so here we are today.
The Mashoff family is a well-known, long-established family in the production of pork in the United States. They have welcomed in a lot of team members from various backgrounds into many different operations, and you oversee somewhere in the neighborhood of about 18,000 mama pigs, I understand, sows.
Absolutely. I work in Nebraska and South Dakota, and again, like you said, about 10 farms out there. And we work every day raising pigs. That's the fun part that we get to do. The even more interesting part is I work with a very strong team of women leadership. 6 out of 9 of my managers that I work with are women. And we work every day together as a team to just make sure we're taking care of the pigs.
Talk a little bit about the skills that the women bring to the job versus their male counterparts. Is there any difference? I'm asking a woman that question.
I think at our hearts, women are caretakers and nurturers, not only of the pigs, but of the people that we work with as well. And both of those pieces are very important. So we set high priorities on taking care of both of those within our farms every day.
those baby pigs in there, their comfort, their health is important to you. If not only for the economic reason, obviously, that it matters to the farm, but at the same time, you want to do what's right. You don't want them uncomfortable.
That's right. And if you remember, in Nebraska and South Dakota, we have some pretty big extremes. We're in Chicago today, same way here. We get really, really hot. You'll see 100-plus degree days in the summer, and you'll see below zero days in the winter. So we do a lot for the environment. There's a lot of innovation and technology that goes into making sure that pigs are comfortable every day. We use what are like air conditioners even in our sow farms to make sure that they stay cool on those hot, blustery Nebraska days.
There is a lot of technology involved in producing pigs today, and folks might be a little bit surprised at that. Give us a highlight or two of something. If you're sharing that story to people who are not involved in the business and they say, oh my goodness, I didn't know that. Is there something quite often that surprises them?
I think the technology that we use to help control the environment is really interesting today. We're seeing new developments where everybody has an iPad, everyone has an iPhone, and some of the technology that we have incorporates that. We can literally monitor the barns from our phones and help alter the environment if something is a little bit off. Increase air speeds going through there to cool it off, or turn on heaters or fans or feeders and waters to make sure that animals are getting what they need on a regular basis.
And that barn is monitored when you're not there, true?
Absolutely. We have alarm systems and backup generators so that if the power ever does go out, we can get power restored and that environment continues to be comfortable all the way through.
What about the health issue regarding consumption of pork? Some people will raise this concern every now and then and say, oh, my goodness, is it good for me? I can have a chop every day of the week, but Mama taught me long ago that everything in moderation is the best. What do you tell folks when they wonder about including pork as a part of their diet?
We have made great strides as pig farmers in producing piglets that are healthier today, not only as a living animal, but also the product that is produced there. We're leaner. We've got cuts that are 16% leaner, and the saturated fat has gone down as well. Our pork tenderloin is just as lean as a chicken breast. So I think consumers can feel confident that, like you said, everything in moderation. But I think there's some great cuts that can be used in a very diverse way.
Scott Bentley is the general manager of World Dairy Expo. And when I talked to you about 5 days before the show started, there was one question you couldn't answer. What color are the shavings in the Coliseum, and what is the setting this year?
Well, that's an answer that I'm happy to give today. So the shavings are blue this year, and that's always a surprise that we unveil the first day of World Dairy Expo. Blue shavings that goes with our theme of discover new dairy worlds. And so we've got a nautical theme in the show ring. We've built a ship. We've got a lighthouse. It's a rustic nautical theme that fits perfectly for our 51st World Dairy Expo.
And this has become somewhat of a tradition. Nobody knows what the setting will be.
It's a closely guarded secret, at least we'd like to think that it is, and that's a pride amongst the leadership and staff. But we put a lot of energy into bringing something new and fresh each year into the show ring.
Talk to me about the commercial exhibitors. A lot of them, is it growing or is it holding steady?
Well, our footprint is of similar size, but we have more and more demand. We have this year, 2017, 884 participating companies. Participating company means they're either exhibiting on grounds or they have an affiliation with one of our exhibitors on ground. So 884 is actually up three companies from 2016, and we still have a wait list for 2018.
I know you get a lot of international visitors, but what about commercial exhibitors? Do a lot of companies come to this show?
Yeah, we have, I believe, this year 28 countries represented in our trade show. And, of course, two countries represented in our cattle show with U.S. and Canada due to health restrictions.
And there was a time when you could bring cattle to the show. That's a little more difficult. There was a time when you would go out to dairy farms. That's a thing of the past.
Yeah, that has been for a number of years, and we now have what we call virtual farm tours, which are educational, informative, highly efficient versus loading up attendees onto a bus and taking them out into the Wisconsin countryside. So our virtual seminars and farm tours go on each of the 5 days of World Dairy Expo, very well attended, very well received.
What would be the leading countries from the standpoint of attendance at this show?
Well, of course, the U.S., followed by Canada and Mexico, and now certainly in the last several years, countries in the Far East, particularly China, have moved right up the ranks, and I believe we'll see China probably come in somewhere in the top five again in 2017.
What about South America? Do we get them here from Brazil, Argentina?
Yeah, always strong and enthusiastic participation from our friends from Mexico all the way down to Brazil and Argentina. And those folks have been with us every step of the way for the last 50 years, and we certainly value their participation and attendance.
Our friend John Onken, who publishes the AgriDairy Business Letter, had an interesting column in this week's edition where he said 10 years ago, somebody exhibited a robotic milker. And we all said, that'll never make it. It'll never work. But it certainly has. I was wrong. I guess a lot of other people were wrong.
Well, labor's an issue in this industry, not just in dairy and in agriculture, but across the entire economy. And I think robotic parlors and milking machines and equipment is not only here and here to stay, but a tremendous growth curve. And I think, you know, what we're now starting to see is that technology is moving in from the early adopters and innovator phase into mainstream. And that's probably going to require a shift in our thinking as an industry. But I'm going to see, I would predict that that's going to move into the mainstream and a lot of our dairy producers in the next 5 to 10 years.
Any other new technology that has caught your eye this year?
Well, we have, as a part of the World Dairy Expo website, a section called Innovation Unveiled. And for me to try to capture the highlights, probably would miss some. So the Innovation Unveiled piece on the World Dairy Expo website allows all of our participating companies to put in their latest technology, their latest innovation, whether it's a product or service. Great resource for attendees and virtual attendees for World Dairy Expo.
So 51 has come to an end, and you're already looking ahead to 52.
We are planning for 2018 for the 52nd World Dairy Expo. At the end of the show ring closing on Saturday evening, we will unveil the new theme art for 2018, and plans are already underway.
What color will the shavings be?
Tune in next year, same time, Orion.
Scott Bentley, General Manager, World Dairy Expo. And welcome back to the Saturday Morning Show. We'll be with you until 6 o'clock, but some more interesting folks to visit with, and we'll talk markets with Jerry Goodell of the Price Futures Group. He'll be checking in with Max Armstrong in just a few minutes. But right now, we say welcome to Samuelson Says, sponsored by Wink Products Company, makers of quality specialty cleaning products since 1947. I'm Orion Samuelson, and this morning I'll be sharing some of your responses to a recent Samuelson Says. But first of all, I want to talk about my friends at Wink Products Company. They want to help make your life easier with a family of professional strength cleaning products, products that really work. Wink Rust Stain Remover is the number one liquid rust stain remover in the country. This professional strength formula dissolves the ugly rust stains on white sinks and toilet bowls, color fast fabrics, and carpets. This little round bottle has been around since 1947, and it's still number one. To learn about all of the fine quality Wink products, check them out at whink.com. That's wink.com. Well, every so often I like to share with you some of the responses and some of the reaction to topics that I talk about here on Samuelson Says. I'd like to do that this week because a couple of weeks ago, Samuelson Says talked about the me first and the entitlement generation. The me first bad driving habits on the highway, cutting people off, and then always having to be first wherever or whatever people are doing. Well, some of the responses, My wife and I have noticed many of the same poor driving habits that you mentioned this morning. And another one on that subject, this morning's topic, right on target, especially the stopping at stop signs and the right turn on red. Both mean the same thing, stop completely. From my yard, I can see three stop signs, and I can count on one hand the number of people that actually stop in a 15-minute period. And the bit on free cell phones also hit home. There are far too many free things out there for people who choose not to work. Another one saying, no free lunch. I like it. And one other one saying, I agree with you on the entitlement generation, 100%. And then from a farmer and father of two boys in Indiana, I get discouraged when I hear people talk about entitlements. Our generation taught them their bad habits. It's our fault. Raise them right, and we shouldn't have this problem. We should focus on the root cause, and that is us. So let's educate, push the benefits of hard work, and encourage parents to stop giving everything to their kids. Make them struggle a little. And then this one. My God, Samuelson, your ignorance is truly baffling. The entitlement generation, now that expects everything should be free, who proclaims that? Where did you hear or read that? Fox and Friends, Limbaugh, Breitbart? Shouldn't the wealthy pay their fair share for health care and education for everyone? Their neighbors, by God. Don't know how you started out, but you're in the money now when you have the typical right-wing mantra of what's mine is mine. And then I can't read it any further because it goes to language that I just don't use. Matter of fact, if I did as a kid, my mother would wash my mouth out with soap. So anyway, that's some of the reaction. Thank you for taking the time to do that. And that's Samuelson Says, a presentation of Tribune Radio Networks. Coming up, Market Talk with Jerry Goodell when we continue on the Saturday Morning Show.
In the studio with us this weekend, Jerry Goodell from Price Futures Group. How's everything at Price? How's the gang over there these days?
Oh, it's doing fine. And we're all waiting around here to see what the heck the USDA wants to say next week in the crop report. But right now, we sure could use this rain they're talking about here.
Well, now, in recent crop reports, they've gone up. They've gone up. Will they go up in the October report?
Well, that's the old tradition, of course. Big crops get bigger. I guess I have a... I think there's a lot of optimism about what we've seen in the first flush of early beans and corn, but that really wasn't the crop that really got impacted as much by the weather. We'll have to see, but right now I'm slightly up on beans and a little down on corn, but really not much change at this time around. USDA was optimistic about GMO and its impact. I guess we'll see if it comes through.
Couple of private estimates coming in. Well, several of them we'll be getting here ahead of the official USDA report. But I noticed a couple of high-profile ones inching up a little bit closer to that 170 a bushel mark on corn. Not quite there, but pretty doggone close to it.
Right. Well, it's an interesting scenario here with the Eastern Corn Belt, the area that really has had the opportunity to get some yields in and some reports in. Anything west of I-35 here, though, has really been shut down in the last week or 10 days. And you know, Nebraska hardly turned the wheel, South Dakota and Kansas, a little bit in North Dakota. So it'll be interesting as to what we finally get some action there. But right now, this rain activity is going to keep us down to a pretty modest increase in the harvesting numbers next Monday.
You don't expect a significant jump then in corn and soybean harvest progress.
Now, we're about up 10% behind on this week's number. I think we could edge up to maybe 15% behind. I'm not sure we're going to end up getting a 10% jump in corn plant harvesting this week.
I heard a comment from a farmer friend this week in central Illinois. He said, we're just kind of waiting on corn. He said, it's kind of nice to see it drying down to the field, and the price isn't very encouraging. So he said, we've hustled over to the soybeans, and there's been some concern about how quickly the beans dried down, how much the moisture level dropped there, resulting in some shattering of the pods right out there at the head.
Exactly. Some of the that's definitely been a feature all the way along here across the whole Midwest. Nobody's excited about harvesting corn and really above 20% because it's a lot more expensive. And well, the prices are at right now, there's no reason to jump out there unless you really have a need to get some reason because of droppage or something like that. And beans, I've heard some numbers down close to that 9 and 10%, which you're starting to lose some yields when you start harvesting that low of moisture. And you have the issue, like you say, of shattering, and some field loss picks up because of the dryness.
Test weight falling off rather substantially. Is it hard for you as a market analyst to get excited about this harvest because it just looks all the way around to be such a big one?
Well, I think the general numbers are going to be more than substantial. I guess the one thing we got to remember, too, here is the fact that because of the reduced corn plantings and that, unless we do have some kind of super jump back up to the 175 yields of last year, we're going to have a billion bushels less than a year ago. Now, we've had an increase in the carryover stock, but we're still going to be half a billion bushels behind on our total supply of corn here in the U.S. I think there's been a little excitement, too, about, oh, we're going to place to put it all. But I think there's going to be space out there to put things away. The beans, the areas of beans increasing, we had 6 million more acres or 7 or whatever you want to call. And that, and if you put 50 bushels in, that's 350 million. That's not a huge jump like you can get in corn with another 3 or 4 million acres of them.
The pieces of the puzzle on acreage, actual acreage put in, those are coming together now, aren't they?
Yes, we'll get the next big adjustment on that on the October updates from FSA and how that puts together with the USDA's numbers. There seems to be a general expectation of a slight increase in beans, somewhere between 3 and maybe 500,000 acres, because of maybe a combination of some of these double crops, or excuse me, replants that we had in the east and some other issues along the way on the price, along, and maybe a modest decline in corn at this point. The big thing is if we go forward here, people anticipating some bring back on that 6 or 7 million of more beans this year to more corn next year, but I'm not sure we're going to get a swing of 7 million. I'm talking 2 or 3 million right now.
What are you talking about?
About the 2018 plantings, because of the big crop this year, the rotation brings you back towards more corn.
Gotcha.
Next year.
But shift back.
Yeah, shift back. The shift back, I don't think we're going to get 6 million going back to corn next year.
In the southern hemisphere, it's planting time. They were wringing their hands for a little bit about it being dry. Did they get the moisture?
They did get an excellent set of moisture here over this last weekend. It moved up from the south. It had been in Argentina and getting them too wet, and it finally moved into Rio Grande and Paraná, even actually into Mato Grosso do Sul and Goiás, which are the areas right around it, Mato Grosso, which is a big province down there in the northwest part of the Brazil. And that I'd have to say that they could use more moisture in the most important state down there. There's some areas that got some rains. I'd have to say, though, a lot of rains didn't get a full inch in a widespread area. So that's going to be quite important, because this is really a month behind when some of these guys want to have the rain and want to have it started. Some have already put the beans in the ground and waited for this rain, which traditionally, once it starts, it really gets going in a big way because of the monsoonal kind of mindset that happens there. But I wonder, there's really, the talk right now is over a week away, maybe even more, like 10 days away for the next real good rain for Mato Grosso. That could be kind of the worst of all things. The sprout doesn't do you a lot of good if you can't keep it going.
Well, we'll continue to watch it. Obviously, it's a long season yet ahead down there, and many things can happen. That's our hope. I mean, that's what we're clinging to here, isn't it?
I think that's a big part of why this market maybe has not been as, partly because we haven't got the crop size in, partly we don't have the pressure of harvest. But I think at the same time, there is people looking around the world to say that things could change dramatically from the super good crops of last year in Brazil to maybe less than optimal the coming year.
But now, how long has it been since they've really had significant crop problems down there?
Well, not so much in the beans, but 2 years ago's corn. That was a huge change. They had actually, you compare this year's, this crop that just came in against the year before, they had a 50% increase. They went from a 65, 67 crop to a 95 crop. If we go back to an 80 crop, that could be interesting.
The demand doesn't appear to be fading at all.
Not on the corn side. Chinese soybeans are fabulous. And I think, and in general, the whole Southeast Asia, the whole world is looking at the feeding situation of going to Western style and the protein approach. It's definitely, I think, on the rise, staying on the rise, and I don't see any real blip going on. I'm not sure we're going to have a 10 million metric ton jump, but I think that's the key feature in this thing, is Brazil does need to have a crop of respectable size. And then, and the interesting thing in the U.S. here, as we all know, people didn't plant oats. They didn't plant barley. They didn't feed the wheat. That's the reason why I had a very good feed number here on the stocks report of 10 days ago. And that feature is going to be quite important as we kind of go forward here. Even I just saw this week that the Saudi Arabians have decided to cut back on their barley purchases because of the fact there's not the supply out there for their normal feeding. And looking at the whole things, corn and soybeans, which is like, I'm not sure how that works over there, but I guess that's what they're looking at.
Historically, back to South America for a moment. Historically, we never get very excited about any problems in the fields in Brazil or Argentina until along about December or January, correct?
That's a usual situation, I think. But I think there's a lot more awareness of that crop and its potential and how important it's become to the crop. I'd have to say that if things aren't picking up a little bit better on their planting progress and things like that, it's going to be well known. I think the biggest twist in this whole thing as we go forward is, what does it impact on the double crop corn up there? That really was a factor that impacted 2 years ago, was the fact that we had a similar delayed planting situation that turned into a stressful planting and harvesting situation for their second crop corn in Mato Grosso.
So pay attention to the southern hemisphere.
Yes, it's coming up. Like you say, it's not going to have the highest recognition, but it's still going to end up being an important factor. But I think the real big feature going forward here in the U.S. is that we've had a kind of a modest improvement in feed demand this year. I think we're going to have continued feed demand. Unfortunately, that's not a sexy thing. It's not, you only see it in the quarterly reports. But with the livestock we've got on the ground, the cattle numbers coming back to the feed yards, the lack of alternative feed grains, lack of enthusiasm for selling wheat when it, you know, supplies are tight in the U.S., I think you put those all together, we could maybe find another mighty billion bushels of feed demand in the U.S., which could be a very interesting total as we look down the road. That's not something on our radar today, though. It's something to keep in mind for next December through January and see how we're doing then.
The pigs, the cattle, the chickens have to be fed, and their numbers are growing.
Exactly, and they don't have much alternatives but good old yellow corn.
Thank you, Jerry. Good to see you. Jerry Goodell from Price Futures Group.
Corn and soybean growers, we invite you to come and learn how to turn practical data and technology into profitable decisions at the second annual Ag Data Conference. It'll be going on at Coralville, Iowa, coming up the end of November. Making sense of precision technology and the data layers derived from it are key to improving your corn and soybean return on investment. And the best way to learn is from actual experience of other farmers and their advisors, along with a hands-on look at the data products, the drones, and the services that drive success. You'll gain insight and more from the Ag Data Conference, designed by the editors of Farm Progress Information brands Corn Soybean Digest and Farm Futures. Get all of the information of the Ag Data Conference by going to the website, theagdataconference.com. It's November 29th and 30th at the Coralville Marriott Hotel near Iowa City, Iowa. theagdataconference.com.
Ben Bransel, retired as Secretary of Agriculture from the state of Wisconsin, but honored at World Dairy Expo. For what reason, Ben?
Well, they are tabbing me as the industry of the person of the year, which was a real shock, but a great honor.
But it shouldn't be a shock when we take a look at your background, because, well, share some of it with us.
Well, I've been one of those blessed people. I started out in production agriculture. I had a chance to spend some time in the legislature and eventually was Speaker of the House, and then had a chance to serve in the Department of Ag, Trade, Consumer Protection as Secretary. I left there, went to the Farm Service Agency as State Director for Wisconsin. Spent 2 years at the university as a state liaison for the College of Ag and Life Science. Then back at the department for an extended period of time. So I've had a chance to work in all pies, all pieces of the pie of agriculture.
But after that, you're now retired. You're going to be bored to death, aren't you?
Farms are never boring. I'm loving going back and farming again. It's kind of where your roots are, and I'm really appreciating the time I have to do that while I can.
And what type of agriculture do you conduct on your farm?
Well, we have beef. We have registered Hereford and Angus cattle, and my son and daughter-in-law are very engaged in the farming operation. They are the sixth generation, and we're planning a production sale, first time ever, on October 15th, and we're kind of excited about that, but it makes for a lot of work to get ready.
So let's talk about the World Dairy Expo, because I would guess you probably attended most of them. What are some of the big changes that you've seen?
Well, the first year, I'd say the auction to raise money was a real effort. I was a junior in high school and bought a heifer calf on that auction. But the quality of the cattle, the extensiveness of what is being displayed, the number of commercial exhibitors that you now find on the grounds. When it started out, it was a pretty small show, and a lot of local businesses were just trying to reach the local farmers. Now people know, and it doesn't matter what dairy business you're in, if you're going to reach someone in the world, here's the place to do it at.
Ben Brantzel, the Industry Person of the Year for the World Dairy Expo people. In coming shows, we'll meet some of the other honorees at the World Dairy Expo this year. News coming up. Stay with us.
Orion Samuelson keeps you connected to the world of business and agriculture on WGN. Hear his reports weekday mornings on The Steve Cochran Show and during the noon hour on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Plus, catch Orion and Max on Saturday mornings at 5 a.m. only on Chicago's WGN Radio 720.